the court, Mr. Watson will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Skip Watson for Ashford Partners. It's difficult to imagine a case of greater impact on an already reluctant commercial lending and leasing industry than the three holdings in this court that a construction duty to complete a punch list is never ending, that it can continue for years. Second, that the measure of damages for failure to complete a construction punch list is not the cost to complete that construction punch list, but is the benefit of the bargain, which as a matter of law, the party has already received the benefit of the bargain upon substantial completion. And third, that erroneous measure of damages can be proven by an expert that says that a fully occupied, continuously used office building used as a company headquarters should be valued as warehouse space, but I don't have any comparables to show you to use as a foundation. Any one of those holdings mandates reversal. Together, they put the commercial lending and leasing industry on its ear. All three require the attention that this court has granted it, and we thank you for that. Ashford cannot be liable for failing to cause the building to be constructed according to plans. That is apparent from looking at the leasing documents and the estoppel certificate, which was part of this process and is part of every sale of a commercially leased building. Estoppel certificates like this one are part of this industry. That's why this case is so important. They got to know that what they are getting is going to have an uninterrupted flow of rent. And that's I would assume, the primary reason we're here.
What happens if there's a latent defect that's discovered later after the estoppel agreement is signed?
Your Honor, that's a great question, and the answer is an inherent in all estoppel certificates. They all accept out one thing, and that is latent defects, or in the language of this one, undisclosed defects. But it's important to note here, and that's the crux of this case, is that the Court of Appeals was able to uphold this on an extraordinarily narrow holding. It said that the liability finding in question one, that we failed to cause construction according to plans, rested, quote, exclusively, close quote, on the failure to complete a single punch list item.
But you took possession before the period of time expired for completion of the punch list items. What obligations, you took possession, you became the landlord, what obligations did the landlord incur by taking the lease before the time to complete? I think there were six, one brief said seven, the other said 4 days. What obligations did you incur?
I understand, Your Honor. That was the point of reading the lease and the estoppel certificate together. If you look at the lease, if you look particularly at the top of page 2, it's tab E in your brief, we have that taking possession of the lease conclusively establishes that the building has been constructed according to plans and that the lessee has accepted the buildings and improvements. Accepted the buildings and improvements subject to what? Subject to completion of the punch list items. But then that's why we have a punch list. Days here, weeks later we come in. Now remember, it's accepting only completion of the punch list items, the disclosed matters. Then we come in with the estoppel certificate, which aims exactly at clarifying the party's duties. And it says the tenant is in possession. It's the things we want to know. They've taken possession. The lease has begun. The term is 25 years. And now, tenant has accepted the premises without exception. Not accepting the punch list, as the lease had said. Now we move to without exception, except what? Except undisclosed items, the latent defects that we were talking about.
Undisclosed items and all requirements for commencement and validity of the lease.
Right, and all requirements for commencement and validity of the lease.
Does that include the completion of the punch list items or not?
Your Honor, we would say that this is clearly trying to say that for the lease to be valid, to commence, because of the exceptions in the prior paragraph of the lease that I just read you, that they've got to be saying at this point that all construction duties, and the court has said completion of the punch list is, quote, a construction-related duty, all of those have been completed.
But how can that be when there's no question that the punch list came out, when was it, just a few days before October the 1st, and then they did take possession. The lease did start. Didn't it?
Yes, sir.
Is there any
did.
Question that the lease started before the punch list was completed?
No question about it. It did.
Then how can that be a requirement for the commencement of the lease?
Or the validity of the lease. It's challenges to the lease, Your Honor. I mean, the or is in there. Remember, this suit's, well, didn't start, but the primary claim by, literally up until a week before trial, was termination of the lease. We've got an invalid lease. Go back and look at the pleadings. It was the trial conference 1 week before trial, before it was said, okay, we're dropping that we have an invalid lease based on failure of consideration because of construction defects, and we're going for loss of benefit of the bargain. That's the point. The validity of the lease was placed at issue by the pleadings in this case. The same thing that went after the validity of the lease is the threshold to say we get benefit of the bargain damages. We're saying that the estoppel certificate, this form that is used in the Texas lending industry, was designed to cut off precisely these things.
Whose duty was it to complete the punch list then?
We believe it was whomever.
Someone had a duty to do that, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And we believe that if that duty passed to us upon the assignment, strike that, it didn't pass to us upon the assignment because the estoppel certificate came in first and there would have been no assignment if we had known about this. The thing wouldn't have been funded. I mean, we wouldn't be here. That's the point. No money, no building, no lease, big lawsuit. But all of it. The party's actions show what really happened here. Estoppel certificate says clean bill of health, construction, and most important to me, no exceptions after previously saying in the lease the punch list is an exception.
Okay, wait.
So the answer is who had the duty to complete the punch list?
The duty ceased at the estoppel certificate. And that is shown by, you cannot have parallel duty to complete the punch list and then come in with a parallel duty to repair defects. And that's the point of this holding. That was the reason for the dual submission.
Your position is your client did not have a duty to complete the punch list.
Precisely.
My question is, who did?
Your Honor, the point is, there was no duty to complete the punch list once it was waived.
By the estoppel certificate?
By the estoppel certificate.
What about the subject to language?
The estoppel certificate was only subject to undisclosed defects, not disclosed defects, which were previously accepted out. That's why the timing of these documents is so critical. So and then the party's actions show, I mean, they acted exactly the way you would expect. For the next 2 years, where was the evidence of the phone calls, the emails, the letters saying, what about the punch list?
Where's the evidence that the caulking of the subterranean wall joints was completed?
Yeah.
Is there any evidence of that? You're saying even if it wasn't done because they signed this waiver, the certificate, then shame on them.
I'm saying that the punch list, by definition, is minor items. You know, that's the way it's defined.
Well, yeah, I understand that.
And the point is that people frequently say, you're right, we're not going to worry about that. And that's shown by their actions. They never came back and said, what about the punch list? Instead, when we finally get down 2 years later to a problem, they send the letter that your tab H that says nothing about a punch list, but does exactly what you would expect to happen under these circumstances. They come in and say, your attention is directed to paragraph 4A of the lease agreement, which says you have a duty to repair the foundation. The duty shifted. At the point of the estoppel certificate in this industry, construction's duty ceases. They have the absolute power at that moment. That's the reason builders hate estoppel certificates. It's the reason that building managers, even in a 20-year-old building, when it changes hands and the lender requires estoppel certificates, the owner hates them because the tenant has all the power to say no. No financing for the new loan until you paint that wall you promised to paint 2 years ago. Or no, I have an electric outlet that's not working that you said you were going to fix. They have the power to stop everything, to stop the sale, stop the financing. They elect to do it or not.
Is there any evidence whether the certificate was negotiated? Do they negotiate these things, or is this a form?
Your Honor, the truth is they're part of every package. I mean, there's nothing adhesion about them. It's just that any commercial tenant expects it.
Do they come from the lender, or who generates it?
It's generated by the lender, Your Honor. I mean, they're the ones. That's why the whole first page is you acknowledge that if something goes wrong, you're paying the rent to us. The lender is wanting to know that the rent is secure, but it's also sent by the prospective buyer because they are not going to sign on the obligation for permanent financing and accept the building until they know construction is complete. That's the point.
Well, obviously something went wrong here. So what would be let's say you're right on the law, what would be the remedy for someone like this? If I'm going to rent this building here and have it redone and later find out that the roof is leaking and there's mold, and we know that there's no coverage for that. But
good question, Your Honor. Exactly what these people did, exactly what Echo did. You write the letter, you look at the lease, and you say, you are obligated for these repairs. If you would, look at the lease at paragraphs 4 and then compare it to paragraph 19 on page 15. Paragraph 4 says we have the duty to repair the foundation, to replace the roofs, to have the exterior walls. Everything else is on them. They assume that duty. They assumed it when they signed the lease and then when they signed the estoppel certificate.
But for the estoppel certificate, then Ashford would have the duty to complete the punch list items, is that correct? Because it was the assignee?
Yes, Your Honor, I would assume that unless the time came, it ran out, and we have what happened here, and 2 years goes by, and there's not a telegram, a candygram, or anything else saying
that,
what about it.
The four-day period between the time of the assignment and the time of the expiration of the punch list obligation, that duty would have been yours, but for, under your argument, the estoppel certificate.
For the purpose of this argument, that's what we're assuming, to make it clean, Your Honor. We don't know what would happen under those circumstances, and we didn't really brief that. But what we know is what happened here. But the critical thing, yes,
the certificate also says this. I understand you're focused on the without exception language, except for undisclosed defects. I understand that. But the certificate says in another place that the certificate, quote, shall not impair or diminish any of landlord's obligations to tenant under the lease. What meaning does that language have in terms of the punch list?
Your Honor, it has to mean, I mean, since we are clearly saying there are no more extant duties, it has to be applying to the obligations that are not eliminated by the estoppel certificate. Otherwise, what's a stop? What's the point of saying this is an estoppel certificate? That clause has to apply to the remaining duties that are not addressed by the estoppel certificate.
So punch list items, so the signing the estoppel certificate would always impair or diminish any duties, even if they're part of the punch list item?
If they are addressed in the estoppel certificate, if there's a representation being made that there are no more exceptions and that all construction is complete, yes, I mean, those things are clearly going to be waived. I see my time is up, Your Honor.
Are there any further questions?
Well, I wanted to ask you about attorney's fees, but we can take care of that, I guess, on rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Cash will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. It's undisputed that the lease had a duty imposed upon the landlord to cause the building to be completed in accordance with the plans. It is also undisputed that that was not done.
What does minor punch list items mean?
I think it means
any context, because certainly foundation work is not a minor punch list
item. And I think it means anything that wasn't done. And the problem is we're tenants, not engineers. We do water work. One of the things that we knew is that they hadn't caulked all the way below grade. What impact that would have, we didn't know. And Mr. Watson is right. We didn't know until 2 years later, after water had gotten under our foundation through this uncaulked panel and caused the foundation to heave and settle. That's the first we knew, and that's when we put them on notice. We didn't reference a punch list because that's not what we do. Punch list items are those items that are left undone, and it's undisputed this was on the punch list. Caulking between tilt wall panels below grade.
Was the building functional for that 2 year period and then thereafter?
The building was functional, and we inhabited the building, we stayed in the building. And in fact, the lease, we felt, didn't give us an opportunity to leave, and if we did leave, there would be an accelerated rent of $25 million, is I think what the number was. What the business decision was, and it was in the testimony at trial, is we're gonna stay and see what a jury says we should do. We're gonna live with it. And I'll get to the damages about warehouse space. Yes.
What purpose does the estoppel certificate serve if we accept your view?
An estoppel certificate serves the purpose of letting the landlord know that they have a flow of rent coming and that everything necessary to commence the lease has been done. We don't dispute that. But if you look at the lease, substantial completion, us taking possession, is what's necessary to commence the lease. And the evidence at trial is we have not missed a lease payment.
Excuse me just a second. I thought you said that the estoppel certificate is necessary to commence the lease, and then you just said occupancy at substantial completion commences the lease. Which one?
The estoppel certificate does not commence the lease. The purpose of the estoppel certificate is to let the lender or the new landlord know there are no impediments to us paying you rent, and there haven't been.
But when you sign the estoppel certificate certifying that construction is substantially complete, and yet from the lender's perspective, this caulking, which led to the damage, which could have had the effect of, I guess, making the office building uninhabitable, the lender, their risk assessment there is compromised by the fact that you signed this certificate of estoppel. I mean, isn't that the purpose, so that the lender knows that their investment is secure because you have said construction's done?
Well, and we did say construction's done, but we didn't say that the building is without flaws. You have to look at the lease, and what substantial completion means is that it is subject to the completion of the punch list.
If it's a flaw, how is that not building according to plans? Because that was my next question. You know, when does the duty to build according to plans end? Any defect that arises later, you could come back and sue for failure to build according to plans.
And actually, that's not true, because there can be a maintenance problem. Perhaps they didn't do things they were supposed to do. Built according to the plans is very specific. There were a set of plans, and in fact, I believe they were Exhibit B to the lease. There are a set of plans that have to be followed. The plans very clearly, and each of the experts for Ashford testified that the plans called for caulking below the surface. That was part of the plan.
When does that duty end?
It doesn't end. But here's the issue. Regency is very clear that you can only breach a duty once. And the interesting thing about Regency is, I think, even though it's cited by Ashford, it actually supports our position, because as the court is aware, in Regency, the reason that the subsequent landlord was not held liable is because the 45-day period to complete the tenant build-out had expired. So when the new tenant came, when the new landlord came in and the tenant sued the new landlord for failing to do the build out, the court said it was already breached at the 45-day point. This landlord didn't assume that. We have exactly the opposite here. There is a 30-day best efforts clause to finish the punch list. They took possession during that 30-day period. So they stepped in during that period. And the interesting thing about the estoppel certificate, and counsel does a nice job of trying to say it cuts off the duty. It doesn't change the duties. The duties are set forth in the lease. The problem with the estoppel certificate is it's an affirmative defense, waiver or estoppel. They have to prove the elements at trial. If you look at the reporter's record, yes.
All this, so you agree with petitioner that the duty to complete the foundation to do the caulking did not arise from the construction contract. It arose from the lease.
It arose from the lease,
so
yes.
Same duty you're arguing, but separate source.
Yeah, it arose from the lease. And the interesting thing about the estoppel certificate, they pled very narrowly estoppel and waiver, which I don't think their pleadings covered the estoppel certificate, but assume it did. Give them that. As affirmative defenses, they were required to submit those to the jury and get answers on them. There are elements, and the Court of Appeals pointed out in their opinion, the elements of each affirmative defense. Not only did they not submit a jury question, once the exhibits were admitted en masse at the beginning of the trial, the estoppel certificate wasn't mentioned in opening, it wasn't mentioned in closing, and not a single question was asked about it.
Was the duty already breached at the time the estoppel certificate was signed, or does that four-day window mean it wasn't breached? I mean,
it was not breached, and here's why. Because they had a 30-day best efforts time. They were still within that 30 days.
How many days within that 30 days?
I'm sorry?
How many days within that 30 days were they?
I think there were 30 days to complete it, and I think they took over, I think it was a week before, 7 days before the expiration. But let's say that we had sued during that 30-day period, and we sued and said, you didn't cause this to be built in accordance with the plans because you didn't caulk below grade. The response, and a proper one from a good advocate like my opponent, would be, this is premature. Your claim is not right, Mr. Cash. You can't bring this. We're still in our 30-day window. We have time to complete this. So you can't bring a breach of lease case because we're still within our time. Well, if they're still within their time, then they're still within their duty. And so the problem they have is they did not submit, they didn't question, they didn't prove a single element of waiver or estoppel. So unless this court is ready to hold that as a matter of law, signing an estoppel certificate stops you from enforcing things that happened before in the lease, they cannot prevail on the estoppel argument.
Well, if that's not the purpose of the certificate, to put in writing that you are estopped, everything's good, except what we don't know about, undisclosed matters. If that's not the purpose of it, as the question came out earlier, exactly what is the purpose of the certificate?
The purpose is to let the lender know we are in possession of the building. It is substantially complete. All of the things we have.
But you already know it's substantially complete.
You're
in the building.
Correct.
After you get a certificate of occupancy, and that means it's substantially complete. They all know that. What's the purpose of the estoppel certificate?
To tell them that we know of nothing that will prevent us from paying your rent. And that was absolutely true. But one of the interesting things about the estoppel certificate is one of the things that they need to prove is reliance. There was not a single question of Mr. Considine, their representative, did you rely in any way on this estoppel certificate? In fact, if you look at the document itself represents to us that Ashford is already our landlord. It says landlord, Ashford Partners. So they're holding out to us when they send us the estoppel certificate, Ashford's already our landlord. Then
doesn't
they tell
your
us,
argument depend on saying that when the certificate said tenant has accepted the premises without exception, it just doesn't mean that. That means some exceptions.
I would agree with that. I think what it means is that we've accepted it without any exceptions to paying the rent, except for undisclosed defects, and ironically, it was never disclosed to us that they had not completed this part of the punch list. So that could actually be an undisclosed defect. We knew the defect, we didn't know they hadn't fixed it. We didn't find that out until 2 years later when they dug it up and their engineers came in and said, that's a problem.
Don't you get some kind of a certification on the punch list items? We've done this, this, this. Isn't that?
No.
You don't get that?
No, we did not. And there's no evidence in the record that that was ever offered or requested.
What does the lender do to protect itself from something like this? Don't they hire their own independent engineer or inspector to come out?
They could. I don't know if they did in this case because there was no evidence of that. But that's what I think a prudent lender would do. I think the lender would have to protect themselves or get representations from the landlord, who before they buy the building certainly would go in and you expect during their due diligence period would do that research.
Well, when considering though how the rule that you advocate is going to impact the marketplace, if you will, doesn't it render certificates of completion mostly meaningless?
Not at all.
What will they mean after we say that it didn't mean anything here?
Not at all. And we're not saying it doesn't mean anything. And it's not, the impact on the market will be if you tell tenants that if you sign an estoppel certificate to benefit the new landlord, that you're cut off from your rights. And even though the certificate says on its face, nothing herein will diminish the duties or responsibilities of the landlord, it really doesn't mean that. It's gonna cut you off and you're not gonna have a claim anymore. That's what will ruin the commercial leasing business, because who's gonna wanna lease? If this court holds that an estoppel certificate, and remember, it's going to have to be as a matter of law, because they failed to submit the jury question on waiver and estoppel. If this court holds that a matter of law, signing an estoppel certificate cuts off your rights if the building wasn't bought or wasn't built properly, if that's what you hold, but as an attorney, how could you ever let your client sign an estoppel certificate again?
But doesn't the lessee still have the obligations, as opposing counsel said, under the lease and the contract, the landlord still has the obligations to maintain the building, the roof, the foundation. I mean, those are negotiated between the lessee and the lessor, it seems like.
They do have repair obligations, the roof and the foundation, and that's it.
Okay, but that's a negotiated item. What is the continuing obligations, respectively, have been negotiated in the lease?
That's true.
So you still have rights.
But it's also negotiated that they will cause the building to be built properly, because the reason that those are separate
right,
duties.
But to say that an estoppel certificate cuts off all rights of the lessee to have the landlord to keep a good building around them is maybe an overstatement, it seems like.
Not if the building isn't built properly, because there are some bad builds that aren't reparable. The jury found in this case, despite five shots at a repair, the reason I believe that the jury gave us future damages is, and they said that the landlord didn't breach their duty to repair, is he did his best. We said that in closing argument. He gave his best shot to fix this building, but he couldn't because it wasn't built right. We waived everything in this lease, if you look. We waived so many warranties, but we didn't waive our right to have it built according to the plans.
Section 1 is very broad, cause the lease space to be constructed pursuant to the plans, and the Court of Appeals said, well, that refers to the only dispute in the case, which was the failure to finish one punch list item. That's your position? I mean,
that is our position, and it is true that it was.
So then let me ask you, if the contractor, if your complaint was against the contractor for failing to finish that punch list, you'd be limited to damages for repair. Is that right or not?
We would have no claim against the contractor, because we have no privity of contract with the contractor.
If whoever did was
Ashford
claiming against the contractor, that would be their measure of damages.
That would be their measure of damages.
Why is yours broader?
Here's why ours broader. We didn't buy a building. At the end of the lease term, we don't own the building. We own nothing. We are renters. What we bought is the right to occupy certain space for a certain amount of time, that space being of a certain quality for a certain payment. What we got is the right to occupy space that was much less than what we had bargained for that same amount of time at that same price.
Seems to me the owner would make the same argument. I bargained for a building that was this quality. That's not what I got.
Well,
and the damages would be, okay, fix it.
And that would be his. Fix it. But what if you can't? And here's let me use a hypothetical
what
example.
What evidence is there that it couldn't be fixed?
I think the fact that we were still 7 years later, after four engineers said we fixed it, we were still having water intrusion, and it was still because it hadn't been caulked. So at the trial, I think the proof's in the pudding. Years later, we're still experiencing the same problems. But let's look at it differently. Let's say that we're a tenant and the air conditioning, the plans called for a certain quality of air conditioner and a lesser quality was put in. Same with the heater. So we're cold all winter. It doesn't get above 50 degrees. And all summer, it doesn't get below 90. The builder and the landlord negotiate, yes, we'll come out and we'll give you what the plans called for. But because of construction problems, we're not going to be able to get that air conditioner in for 5 years. Landlord says, that's fine. At the end of 5 years, he gets his air conditioner. His building is what he bargained for. But we suffer for 5 years with no heat and no air conditioning. We don't have a claim against the contractor. We don't have a claim against the landlord because he is giving us, he's causing it to be constructed eventually. But we suffer that harm month after month after month after month.
Good point. What's the evidence in this case that the failure to caulk caused your client continuing business issues, business losses, problems for the 2 year period, and the evidence that that was going to continue for 25 years into the future?
The evidence was their engineers all said that one of the main problems causing these problems, the heaving and the settling, was the failure to caulk below grade. Their witnesses said that, and it was undisputed. What our evidence was is we showed that we're trying to run a business. We had to cancel meetings. We had flooding in our place. We had cracks on a regular basis. We had doors that wouldn't close. We had doors that wouldn't open. The building was of a lesser quality. And the interesting thing, they complained that we compared this, that our experts said, what would warehouse space cost? Even though we were occupying it.
Before you go down the warehouse road, what was the damages evidence, the quantification of the problems you talked about? Canceled meetings, doors didn't close. Was there lost profits? What was there?
There was not. We did not seek damages for every time something happened. What we said is this building is of a lesser quality. Their expert said it will continue to have these problems for years, even after a fix, because it will have to dry out and settle. And he said it could go 5 or 10 years into the future. The jury determined that they hadn't fixed it yet, so maybe they wouldn't be able to.
Okay, well, Mr. Cash, two things.
Yes.
Mr. Watson said that your expert that testified didn't have comparables, so that's not sufficient evidence. And before you finish, I want to hear your argument about the attorney's fees and how that should be dealt with.
Okay. Let's start with our evidence on damages. We brought someone who is familiar with the real estate market and who said and testified that he did use comparables. He did not attach any to his report, but he said, I looked at warehouse space. I looked at it and I used that. There was no objection or motion to exclude because his report didn't meet the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. So that argument's waived. But let's step back for a second. What we said is this is inferior space. Even if we take our expert and discard him completely, assume that he did not testify at all. Their expert, Mr. Kangeiser, testified without objection and introduced comparables that were as much as $3 or $4 a square foot less than ours. And the explanation he gave was that they were lesser quality. They hadn't been built out as much. The damages we were awarded were not $3 or $4 less, it was $1 or $2 less per square foot. So if we hadn't put on our expert at all, their expert's testimony supports our verdict.
But they made some objections at trial, just not specific enough to address the contentions they make here on appeal, because their brief reflects they made objections at trial. I haven't looked at the record.
What I'm saying is their expert's testimony, which wasn't objected to by either side, supports our verdict. They did object to our expert, but if we ignore our expert, when their expert testifies, $3 or $4 a square foot less is this comparable, and he testified our building, the rent we're paying is fair, if it's in good condition. Their representative, Mr. Considine, testified on cross that he agrees. Us paying full rent for this building wouldn't be fair because it isn't in good condition. He admitted that. So if you're the jury, you have their evidence, ignore ours, you have their evidence from their expert of what a lesser building should rent for. An admission by their expert that we're paying a fair rent only if our building is in good condition.
Under your theory, would you still be entitled to damages if the caulking didn't cause the flooding. In other words, you got a building
that did not comply
with building specifications. The caulking wasn't done, but there was no flooding. There were and no canceled meetings. You wouldn't because you received a building that was inconsistent with what you thought you had leased.
But so we would have no harm. We would have no harm because the building wasn't causing any problems. It wasn't a lesser building if it wasn't causing this flooding.
So why would you not have to, as Justice Wainwright was asking, prove what harm you was caused?
I think we would have to prove the harm that was caused, and we did. There was ample evidence of canceled meetings, flooding, inconvenience on a daily basis. It wasn't quantified in a dollar amount because what we were saying is all these things add together to make our building less than that which we paid for.
Then according to your argument, Ashford Partners wasted $300,000 trying to fix the caulking.
I would agree with that.
They never should have done it because you're still going to get $1.4 million for the different value in the quality of the lease space.
I say they wasted it because the fixes didn't work. If the fix had worked the first time.
Weren't, according to you, capable of repairing.
I don't think they were.
So they never even should have tried.
I think you don't know if they won't work until after you try. And I'm sorry I didn't get to the attorney's fees argument, but my time is up.
I'm sorry, Chief. One other question about the standard for the measure of damages. The cases relied on by the Court of Appeals and by you in your brief, Rainwater and Graves are 1944, 1999 cases. Graves is writ refused, so it has the precedential value from this court. And then in your brief, you added Mays versus Pierce, a Houston 2006 Court of Appeals case, Pett denied. Point is, we haven't addressed this standard in a long, long time, if at all. The cases that are cited, however, deal with damages measure where what was leased was less than what was agreed to, one room instead of two, or I changed my mind and you don't get it. Here, you got it. You acknowledged it was fully functional the whole time, but there were some problems with
it.
Well, functional, maybe not fully, but functional the whole time. There were some problems with it. Those cases, at least the argument is, deal with a different factual scenario. Should they establish the measure of damages in a case where the facts are perhaps materially different?
Less can mean a lot of things. Less can mean less square footage, but it can also mean lesser quality. If you go out to the car dealership and you lease a Cadillac and they give you a 10-year-old Hyundai, you didn't get what you bargained for, and you should get the difference in the value between those two. That's our argument.
Well, maybe you got the expensive car and just had a spot on the seat, not a wholly different car.
Maybe the expensive car would overheat every time you drive it more than 2 miles, or leak every time it rained and it wasn't fixable. I think that might be a little bit closer. And again, the only thing I would say on the attorney's fees is the only claim that would entitle them to attorney's fees, they dropped, which was their declaratory judgment action. So they wouldn't be entitled to them.
May I ask just one question?
Yes, Lerman.
If the court were to decide that the correct measure of damages is the cost of repair, I understand that you're not in favor of that, but if we were to do that, and it's not repairable, as you're saying, then what do you think the correct measure would be?
I don't know, and I'll be honest with you. From a tenant's point of view, the cost of repair, we have neither the right nor the duty to repair. So the tenant would never be made whole with the cost of repair. What we suffer is the difference in what we have to live with on a daily basis, like the air conditioner analogy. So I couldn't tell you. What I will admit to the court is we didn't put on any cost of repair damages because we didn't pay to repair.
May it please the court, there were no cost of repair damages from the other side because we fixed it. We're the ones who repaired it. We did precisely what we were required to do under the lease.
The other side says the jury found differently. What's your response to that?
Well, apparently I'm misreading the verdict. Question two, did Ashford fail to comply with the lease by failing to maintain the foundation of the lease space in good repair?
How do you reconcile that with the future damages for lost value?
Your Honor, the only thing I can figure out is that if you look at the closing argument, it was very clear that there were two separate arguments going on. Failure to build in accordance with the specs was talking about everything, including failure to caulk, but there is one section in there where it says this case is about soil. They use the improper fill. You know, that's what's causing it to heave. Well, that's not on the punch list. That's not the exclusive reason for liability in this case.
So you disagree with the Court of Appeals that even though the question one is broad, the only real dispute was the one item on the punch list. You disagree with that? You think there was some complaint made along the way that could have been this, could have been that?
I'm saying that you look at the testimony, look at the closing argument. Everything that went wrong, of which one, the punch list item was one of many, was grouped into the argument under question one and the damages to support question one. But when we got to the only piece of liability that the Court of Appeals said could stand, the punch list, quote, the exclusive basis of liability, the jury answered that no. We did not fail to maintain the foundation in repair. That's conclusive. The jury has spoken. That's over. There are no ongoing damages related to the exclusive point of liability. What about remedies? The parties addressed remedies. We did do exactly what the lease requires. Again, they are trying to obtain non-construction contract damages for suing us for a construction contract breach. It doesn't matter that they didn't hire the contractor. They contracted with us to build a building to suit. They're saying we didn't build it according to plans. That is precisely what substantial performance was designed to correct. It was to say you did get the benefit of your bargain as a matter of law. If you go back and read all of the cases that this court has cited in its prior opinions on substantial performance, they get down to the only time that we get into this argument of does benefit of the bargain come into play is when it can't be repaired. The jury has found it was repaired, it was maintained, so that's out, or the repairs cost more than the lost benefit of the bargain. That's always been the rule of this state. That's why this case has turned that upside down. But look at the lease. The lease is consistent with that.
But counsel, the construction cases that give a measure of damages between the builder and the owner, you think those directly apply in a lease context like this one?
Absolutely. I mean, the sole reason given for not applying them was repairs benefit the owner. Well, then, why are we being sued for failing to repair? Why was question two in there if they benefit the owner? Their point is we didn't repair it, but the jury disagreed. And when the jury disagreed, this case ended. We did our job under the lease. We maintained the foundation in good repair, and in doing it, we fixed the punch list problem.
A lessee is in a different position than an owner. An owner wants the building the way it's supposed to be and done, and you know, I may own it 100 years. A lessee comes in and says, I don't care about that, so long as it does what I want it to do and it's pretty and nice and I get to make a lot of money using it. They're in different positions, though, in terms of contractual duties and rights, aren't they? That doesn't...
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor.
Does that suggest that the construction... measure of damages cases may not be exactly on all four with the lease damages cases?
There's no reason that's been articulated why they shouldn't, Your Honor. As a matter of law, the lessee is the equivalent of a fee ownership. He has the right to the space, quote, to the exclusion of the owner. It is exclusively his to use. The cases even say it's the equivalency of a fee. This is not renting a room at the DoubleTree for a week and somebody else is going to be coming in. This is a 25-year building built to their specs. It is a build-to-suit lease. They are the owner. The measure of damages, the sole measure of damages after substantial completion, is the cost of repair they don't have any cost of repair because we fixed it and the jury said we fixed it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. The cause is submitted and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.